Why is tracing so hard?
You know, it can be a very, very large data set. The other thing is for tracing, you know, you're effectively having to group together a lot of individual events or logs or different messages. There's a lot of ways that you can do it. You know, I think also just in general, it was probably the newer of the compared to logs and metrics that have been around forever. It's a lot newer of a concept. And so I think, you know, just the space is less mature. And I think the thought process around tracing is less mature across organizations.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have the founder and CEO of Edge Delta, Ozan Unlu, on the program. Ozan, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to kind of do this with you, Brian. I think we're excited to chat through some tech stuff. I know, obviously, you have quite a bit of experience in the space. So excited for the chat.
I just made all of that stuff up. I haven't actually worked in tech ever. I'm joking. But would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Yeah. So my name is Ozan Unlu. I'm the founder and CEO of Edge Delta. Edge Delta is in the observability space. So, you know, my background, I spent now, if I think about the earliest days of Perfmon in Windows, I have been in the space now for about 20, 25 years. Was at Microsoft early in my career, and then I went to a company called Sumo Logic, which was, you know, one of the first real big multi-tenant cloud-based solutions in the space. And then, you know, founded Edge Delta about 5 years ago. So, you know, pretty excited for what we're able to do in the observability space, and you know, hopefully, the listeners here will be excited to hear me talk about it.
Yeah, what is Edge Delta?
Yeah, so Edge Delta. So, you know, in the early days of observability, what we call kind of the Gen 1 solutions, there was a lot of this concept of store and explore, which is effectively that you take all of your various different data sets, you put it into a giant bucket, and then you search that data in that bucket. So, you know, this is a concept of either, you know, SQL or ANSI SQL or, you know, these query languages that allow you to query this data. In those days, when a lot of those platforms, generation one platforms were being designed, you know, the average customer might have had 5 or 10 gigabytes of data. And so realistically, we don't have 5 or 10 gigabytes of data on average for the average customer anymore. It's more moved from, you know, gigabytes
like
to
minute,
terabytes.
Right? It's like five gigs per minute of logs to observe.
Sure, you do need a newer way of doing things. Yeah. So, you know, for Edge Delta, what we really look at is in the future, when you can no longer analyze every single piece of log, metric, or tracing data, what does that future look like? And, you know, effectively, that's what we're building.
Nice. And so how does it differ? I mean, there's other observability platforms out there. There's some startups out there using AI to do this. Like, how do you guys differentiate and kind of maintain that moat and against the existing players in the space and up and comers?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. So, you know, if you look at the history of observability, you know, if we go back to the early days, obviously Splunk was, I would say, probably ahead of its time. And if you look at the strong players in logs, it was, you know, Splunk early. Obviously, there was Elastic. There was Sumo Logic. If you look at the big APM players, you know, there was AppDynamics, New Relic, and some Datadog in there. You look at, you know, some of the metrics players. Obviously, there's Datadog and SignalFX. And so I think, you know, in the early days, it was this concept of what we call MELT, which was, you know, metrics, events, logs, and traces. And that I think is pretty core to even what teams are trying to do today. I think, for instance, even just tracing, a lot of teams like to talk about it. I don't think a ton of teams are doing tracing at scale very well. But that's the core of observability, is those different types of what people call pillars of data.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so at Edge Delta, the way that we look at it is that those are pretty well-defined problems. Those are things that, you know, for instance, for logs, you want that to be, you know, searchable. For metrics, you know that you want them to be able to be on a dashboard, and tracing, obviously, you want to be able to go end to end. And, you know, events is a whole other thing that's pretty interesting and a lot more modern as we start to think about, like, you know, what can you creatively do? What should be a log? What should be an event, et cetera? Where Edge Delta kind of focuses is more on, you know, for lack of a better term, the edge. The way that we look at the edge is, let's look at, you know, pipelines and ingest. How is your data actually coming into these other platforms? And then on the other side of it, on the other side of the edge, where we've traditionally, I think, called this a little bit more AI ops, is, okay, how are you actually looking at and give you a little bit of a leg up on simply it being a manual process, you know, done by a human. So, you know, I would say for our differentiation, we are best in class, best in market at the ingest side of the house and then the remediation. And I think for us, our core platform of kind of that metrics, logs, tracing for us is what we look at as it needs to be good enough for the customer. It needs to work, but it's not necessarily going to be our differentiation. Like, we're not going to go build a better version of log search that lets you, you know, have a deeper query or anything like that. So, you know, I think for us, that's we get really excited when we think about the, you know, transforms and the way that which you can route your data to various different downstream destinations. And we get really excited when we think about what are the most advanced ways that we can pre-process and pre-transform these data sets to be able to go feed these into, you know, downstream AI and LLMs and machine learning that can then give you these insights better than you could do manually.
Why is tracing so hard?
It can be a very, very large data set. The other thing is for tracing, you know, you're effectively having to group together a lot of individual events or logs or different messages. You know, so there's a lot of ways that you can do it. You know, I think also just in general, it was probably the newer of the compared to logs and metrics that have been around forever. It's a lot newer of a concept. And so I think, you know, just the space is less mature. And I think that the thought process around tracing is less mature across organizations.
So how do you think, like, going back to like your early career, how do you think that kind of shaped your current startup and what you're doing now? Like, walk us through that journey from, I see here in like my notes, you even worked at Boeing. I worked at Boeing right out of college as well. So maybe you could walk us through kind of how you got to do what you're doing.
Yeah, that's an old scar that you're opening up. You know, Boeing was interesting. It actually was interesting that I was there in, you know, 07, 08, which was supposed to be when they released the new 87, right? I think now you can look back and say, you know, notoriously, there was a lot of delays there. And I think there was even some brand new documentary that got released on Netflix or something that was talking about kind of those days in that era. Boeing, I think my job was pretty boring, to be honest. I was a data engineer and I was, you know, inputting data into various different, you know, databases and systems and, you know, writing macros and Visual Basic. I mean, it was some really, really fairly low basic stuff.
I remember going to the data center. It was on the east side of, I think it was somewhere in like Kirkland or Bellevue, Redmond. It had a big data center over there. I don't know if you remember that or if it's still there, but I remember touring it in 2003. I was just out of college, so I took like a post-grad internship there. And it could have turned into a full-time role, but after the summer, I was like, I don't want to work here.
It's funny. I actually lived in Kirkland for a little while. Those were more in my Microsoft days. But at Boeing, I was actually up in Everett, right next to the big, big factory.
I'm from Linwood, Mount Lake Terrace kind of area. So I went to Meadowdale High School in Linwood.
Okay, perfect. So, yeah. Perfect. So, right, so yeah, I mean, up in Everett, yeah. That was fun because I don't know how many people know this, but that was the largest, or I think still is, the largest building in the world. So it was as big as, I think it was 10 Empire State Buildings laid on its side. Huge. And I think it takes
like 45 minutes to drive around it or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so funny enough, the closest coffee shop that was any good was actually in that building. So, you know, in order for us to grab coffee when we were on the job, we had to actually, like, you know, put on the safety glasses and actually walk through the factory to go to the coffee shop.
That's fun. That's fun.
So that was probably the most interesting part of that, you know, that part of my career. And then, you know, at Microsoft, I think it was very interesting because when I joined Microsoft in 08, you know, it was right as AWS was starting to gain steam. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that timing to be able to be at, you know, effectively the best competitor to AWS, which, you know, obviously ended up being called Azure in the later days. And I was
It was like Red Dog back then or something like that.
Red Dog was the name of the operating system. And then even before that, there was like this concept of like, you know, it was like, Microsoft was famous for acronyms. So it was, you know, BPOS, like Business Productivity Online Suite.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of that kind of morphed into what eventually ended up becoming Azure. And, you know, that was interesting because, you know, it was the first time I think many of us saw things at that scale. Obviously, you know, you had the Microsoft network and you had, you know, I had spent some time on the server side of Microsoft as well. But it was really the first time where you saw things at that large of a scale.
Right. Yeah. Back to my story on Boeing. It was funny. We went to the data center. This is 2003. So it was state of the art. They had a robotic hand you know, when you ran like a query in their data system, this 2003, they could, in the back end, there's literally a robot that would go grab the cold storage, like the 20 gig hard drive off a shelf, like in a little pod or whatever, pull it out, and then plug it into the system. That's how they solved like really deep, cold, large data storage. And these are 20 gig drives. I would imagine now they're probably like petabyte drives or something like that, or hundreds of terabyte drives.
Sure. I didn't stay close enough to the hardware side of it to know, but you know, it's interesting because you're bringing me back. Like if you went and looked at the production, you know, Azure data centers from back in the day, then I mean, everything was at such large scale and so precise. And I mean, we didn't even have access to touch that stuff, right? It's like we had to schedule a call with that data center to be able to even go in there. But then, you know, you contrast that to all of our, you know, test and lab environments back in the day. And it was, you know, safe to say it was a lot less serious and a lot less organized in a lot of the testing environments. So that was some interesting experiences.
Yeah. And then so Microsoft Asimo would walk us through that transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at Microsoft, I worked on some really exciting projects, and obviously at a very large scale. One of the more exciting ones was about almost 12, 13 years ago at this point, was GPUs and data centers. At the time, we thought that, you know, that was potentially a competitive advantage. AWS did not have GPUs and data centers. I think the reasoning and the logic there was sound. I think about 12 years ago, at that time, GPUs were mostly used for, you know, video rendering and some basic things. I think, you know, although technically Bitcoin had been invented by then, it wasn't a big thing. So, you know, I think it was the right solution, the right idea, the right strategy, probably just 5 or 10 years too early for the industry. And so, you know, from there,
and why do you think that was too early? Did they not stay that course and did they pivot or tell us about that?
For my knowledge and my experience, there was, I ended up moving on in, you know, 2014. So I'm not quite sure I didn't stay too tight with that project in the history of it afterwards. But yeah, from my perspective, it just, we weren't getting a ton of the traction in the customer base with that specific offering within the Azure ecosystem. So
interesting.
And then, you know, for me, in my history at Microsoft, I was always a good developer, but, you know, I was never a phenomenal developer. I was never the, you know, quote unquote 10X developer that was
how do you know?
You know, I think it's pretty apparent, actually, to, you know, like you can, Microsoft was big enough that, and I always give this advice to people starting on earlier in their career. It's really easy when you're in a fairly large team, and it doesn't have to be huge. It doesn't have to be Microsoft scale, but You want to have enough context around you that you understand, like, am I better than the person sitting next to me? Am I not as good as the person sitting next to me? And I think that gives you a lot of self-awareness and context. And I think at Microsoft, having worked on many different teams, and, you know, people will joke about there was a, you know, a reorg every single 9 months, and you would be moving offices. But I think it did give you a really good understanding of where you are kind of in that whole stack rank within other developers. And
there's that word, you know, I was looking for, the stack rank. And this always bothered me when I was a manager. I ran a pretty large team, and go into these people orientation meetings or people calibration meetings where all the managers debate like who's a star performer and who's a laggard and who's in the middle. And it was always funny to me because, you know, I'd back up and I'd say like, hey, big picture here. Everybody works at Microsoft. Everybody's a really great employee, right? Like you probably don't get hired at Microsoft. Now, that means everybody's really skilled. Okay, great. Is everybody motivated, really, is what it boils down to. Are they working on what they want to work on? Are they truly motivated to deliver value? Yeah, there are some differences in outcomes, but really those outcomes, by the time you get to Microsoft, are really maybe luck, maybe, you know, motivation, ambition, working hard. And so really, like, it becomes more of a psychological counseling kind of job.
And being a politician too, right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great segue as well into, you know, I am also a big believer that everyone is really good at something. And I think to your point, exactly, it's like you have to be motivated. You have to have the opportunity. You need to, you know, luck to be in your favor. But, you know, everyone can be really good at something. And I think for me, looking back then, you know, being a hardcore developer, I think I could have been good and above average and pretty good, but I don't think not super great or phenomenal or a superstar. And so, you know, eventually, you know, I had some friends that were like, hey, look, you know, you're super ambitious. You know, you want to do amazing things with your career and you are technical and you're a developer at Microsoft. You're great at that. But, you know, you could do so much more. Like you have these soft skill sets. You have the ability to potentially, you know, be in front of customers and be able to talk with them. You should really consider kind of this solution architect role. And so that was a big, big draw to me, was to go join, Silicon Valley based startup, Sumo Logic, and go join it as, you know, effectively their first solution architect on the mid-market team. And so that was really what was a change is, hey, look, you know, I could be a good above average developer, or I can try to go find my calling. And, you know, I think that was much closer to my calling.
That's awesome. Thinking about that transition from Sumo to founding Edge Delta, like what was that aha moment where you're like, I think I'm going to leave Sumo and do this thing?
So I was a solution architect, which allowed me to work with a lot of customers. And then, you know, towards the second half of my career at Sumo Logic, I ended up joining or following in the footsteps of the dark side, where I was a back carrying sales rep. So I had kind of like done the full transition of being a software developer, kind of in a dark room, hammering away at my keyboard, all the way over to being a, you know, back carrying salesperson who had quota hanging over their head.
Like existing accounts, like you have like a named territory.
So I had you know, Northwest. So it was, you know, Oregon, Washington, Western Canada.
What a good experience for you as a developer to go all the way to sales, right? Because I think companies fundamentally do two things. We, you know, we build things and sell things, right? And so I think the best founders can do both.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. And I think, you know, for where I went, it was, you know, on the sales side, there are a lot of salespeople that, you know, sometimes this term is used to say coin operated, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes even as an ex-salesperson myself, it's like, you know, you hear some people that say, I'm coin operated. Like, you need to pay me so I can go sell stuff. Mm. And I think that's actually a perfectly fine and honest way to look at your role, is to say like, hey, look, I'm here to go, you know, bring revenue to the business, and revenue is very important for the business. And also my own compensation is important for my business. Okay? That, you know, just for me specifically was not the way that I did, right? So for me, I was a technologist who loves solving big tech problems. And so, you know, my transition to Sumo Logic and being a sales rep there, I think the customers really appreciated the fact that I was working with them to try to solve really big problems. And in doing so, if a byproduct of that happened to be that I made a lot of commission or that I closed a lot of business, you know, so be it. But I was after the big challenges.
Right.
The other thing I would recommend, you know, of course, you know, in this is all pre-COVID, so a lot of the work was also being done on site. And so, you know, any of the large accounts that I was able to close, I would go and get badged. So I'd get a vendor badge, and I'd try to show up at least once a week and work about a half day out of their office working with them.
Nice.
So I think my unique perspective of being an ex-developer, but that was able to be in the front lines, in the trenches with the customers in their office, working day in and day out on their kind of mission critical problems, it did give me a unique perspective for, you know, what other needs are there in the market, and what are the current technologies and their limitations? What are those, what are the lacking characteristics within there? So that was kind of the founding story of Edge Delta, is looking at the technology that were being used and saying, you know, there is a gap here. And that was my kind of starting thesis.
Interesting. And so what was that initial gap that you saw?
Yeah. I mean, I think the initial gap was that, initially for data analytics, you know, people talk about this concept of the pendulum swing. And, you know, I think there's a concept of edge computing that was just starting to get talked about then.
Mm.
And, you know, for myself and my history and seeing the early days of the cloud being formed, the cloud was really the pendulum swinging towards centralization.
Yeah,
exactly. And centralization makes a ton of sense. And even today, even with the latest and greatest,
platform shift, I mean, you see it with OpenAI. That's a pendulum swinging of AI towards central closed systems, and then it'll kind of swing back. And we're already kind of starting to see that, actually. I think, and with AI, and
even with like the best products out there, such as Edge Delta, you're still going to need the cloud. You're still going to need that centralization. So I think, you know, the big concept for Edge Delta is not that you give up on the cloud; it's that you also start to think about what you should be doing on the edge. And so I think for us, it's not that you're ditching one, it's that you really should be doing both at their appropriate locations.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then walk us through kind of the founding of the company, like who was on the team initially. Did you guys start to kind of moonlighting, kind of hacking stuff together and settling it on the side? Or did you kind of rip the Band-Aid and just leave and just, you know, incorporate?
Yeah, I mean, how did that process go? I had to rip the Band-Aid. I think for me, I was very passionate about it. You know, also, obviously, within the observability space, you always want to be respectful and careful and you know, do things the right way. So, you know, for me, it was really about saying farewell to Sumo Logic, and it was great. A great company, IPO, got to $300 million in revenue. Still a great company and great product.
Yeah.
You know, but for me it was really important to really kind of, hey, let's go start fresh. And in the early days, I had to go recruit my co-founder. And you know, when I think about myself not being a superstar at Microsoft, my co-founder Fathi was absolutely the superstar. He was phenomenally good at software development. And you know, in the early days when I first created the product and coded it, you know, my first version, I was like, look, this thing sort of works. But, you know, you could actually go.
Can you go refactor this, please?
Yeah. It's like, you can actually build this thing to be enterprise class. So why don't we scrap what I did and why don't you start fresh?
I love it.
And so we effectively did that. And, you know, I think obviously, you know, bringing him in and him being such a gifted developer and starting to build, you know, obviously raising a seed round, starting to build out the team. I think that was, you know, very exciting time. You know, very quickly, we also ran into, you know, COVID. So that was kind of the early thing that stopped us in our tracks a little bit. And I do remember
how many months into this were you when COVID hit?
I mean, we closed our seed round right in the middle of 2019. So
your first round. Did you do friends and family before that, or was it just seed?
We did not. No. So we jumped right into a seed. And then, you know, I think our first hires that we were starting to make were right in, you know, September, October, November. I mean, this was literally
2020.
Of 2019. So
months. Just starting to kind of formulate a nucleus, got the office lease. All right, we're coming into the office. That was in Seattle somewhere, or?
It was, yeah. It was actually Met Park West, right down in downtown.
Wow.
Funny enough, it was across the street from the Splunk office that was here in Seattle in Met Park East.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head, because that's exactly what we did. We signed this lease, and then all of a sudden we said, you know, hold on a second, you know, we can't go into the office anymore.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, one of the employees who I had known from before had moved to Seattle to join the company and was momentarily crashing in my basement while he was about to find an apartment. And actually COVID stopped him from being able to find an apartment.
Yeah. So you're like, I guess you're in my pod now. I guess we're just going to live together.
Exactly. So, you know, when the concept of like social pods broke out, you know, he and I kind of looked at each other and he said, you know, we said, well, since you and I are already basically living together now, like we can go in the office if it's just us two. And of course, we had another employee that was right down the street who would, you know, they were within our social pod. And sometimes, you know, him and his girlfriend, now wife, would come over and grab dinner with us. Of course, then he was in the pod. So he's like, well, if you guys are going to the office, then I'm going to the office. So, you know, in the early days of COVID, it was the three of us basically in the office. And, you know, looking back now, it's kind of funny. But, you know, anytime we went to like an elevator or a door, it was always like playing rock, paper, scissors on who had to, you know, press the button, because, you know, none of us wanted to get infected.
Like taking your elbow now, and like trying to press the button.
You know, exactly. It wasn't nearly as you know, obviously bad as we thought back then. But we didn't know. You know, nobody knew how bad it was in the early days.
Yeah, it could have been.
Didn't know if it was
Spanish flu bad and like everyone's dying and who knows.
Yeah.
So how much did you rate? Were you guys post-launch, post-revenue when you guys did a seed round, or?
No. So we had an idea on the napkin, and we had a, you know, pitch deck, and we had, you know, we had an early version of the product, but it was,
so you had something to demo. Super. You're like, here's kind of something we think people will pay for.
Exactly. And it was actually, I think obviously being in Seattle, there's always this concept of, you know, do you want to go raise in Seattle? Do you want to go raise the Bay? You know, I think realistically, I think I would encourage everyone to definitely go down the Bay at least for your early stage fundraising, even if just to understand kind of what that market looks like.
And what do you mean by that? You mean actually go plant yourself in Silicon Valley, San Francisco for a month or two and go fundraise on the ground?
You know, you could. I don't think that's actually necessary though. So the way that I would do
anymore,
it
not
is
post-COVID,
that,
I think, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm running this whole venture fund from east of Sacramento, 45, like I'm closer to Tahoe in the middle of nowhere, Sierra Nevada foothills, you know, and I'm just, everything's over camera now. And so I got a nice camera and a nice mic and I'm just chilling over here. I try to avoid going to the city as much as possible, but I did purposely move driving distance, you know, so I could get there in two and a half hours if I had to, you know. So do you actually advise founders to go on the ground and kind of circulate?
I think so. I don't think it's necessary for every single meeting. I think it is absolutely necessary for probably one meeting. You know, I think
for the lead investor, right? Like, I'm going to go pitch to some tier one, tier two VC that has headquarters in San Francisco or Sand Hill Road. Like, I'm going to fly in. They're going to write a $2 million check or something. And I better be there in person. So like, how big was the first round? Who led it? And what was the valuation? All that stuff, if you don't mind sharing.
Yeah. So our first round raised $3 million on a 15 post, and we had two great investors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's solid, it was for a pre-revenue company.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it's the infrastructure space. So, you know, I always talk about, you know, are you making pens or are you building spaceships? And, you know, I think fortunately for us, we're a little bit closer to a spaceship. So, you know, I think no one expected us to have revenue that early. But yeah, I think, you know.
And why is that? Is it just because Edge Delta is just innately kind of almost like deep tech? It's deeper in the stack kind of stuff, right? It is an application, but it's not this purely business user facing business application SaaS software. It's kind of deeper down in the stack, kind of at that platform as a service kind of layer sitting on top of the infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think a good analogy there would be like, let's take, you know, like a vehicle analogy, like a Tesla. You know, if you said, okay, what is maybe the least, you know, the least technologically advanced thing on a Tesla? Maybe the tires, right? But you're not going to go cheap on the tires, right? Like
the tires are
the thing that touches the car to the road. Yeah. And so if you're, you know, maybe you'll say, okay, maybe I want to save a little bit of money on the tires, but do I really want to go with a seed stage tire company where the tire might blow out on the freeway and then my whole family dies? You know, in the data limit space and observability. It was sort of that analogy, which is, you know, hey, if we're going to use Edge Delta to do all of our ingest and transforming of our data on the way in, and guess what? If Edge Delta goes down, everything else goes down, then you can imagine that, you know, there's quite a high bar for quality for our customers.
Yeah, that's amazing. So who are some of your customers? Like, tell us about your progress so far in 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I always want to be careful of this, so I always have to, you know, go with what's listed, you know, on our website.
Yeah, the logo's on the website, yeah.
Yep, logo's on the website, you can go there, they change pretty frequently, so as we get new customers, so I always want to, you know, I never know exactly what stage we are in with the marketing teams over there, so I want to be careful.
Yeah, totally, no, I totally understand. So for folks out there that are listening, you know, we have a lot of people in tech that listen to this podcast, and you know, I came from cloud, obviously at Azure and AWS. What are some of the things that they should be asking themselves about this area? And what are some of the questions, if they answer yes to, they should probably get in touch?
So I think for us, it's really about, you know, there are some big players in the space. For instance, Datadog is very well known, right? Datadog has a great technology. I think the consensus across the industry is that it's also pretty wildly expensive. And so, you know, I think the key is if you are a company where you have mission critical systems that when they go down, it's very expensive and you don't want to break the bank and you frankly want some of the more advanced features with more of a Gen 2 platform for observability, I would say come talk to us. We are, you know, passionately in love with data in this specific space and we would love to work with you. And so, you know, for us, again, the pipeline capabilities are pretty advanced in this market. The automated insights capabilities on the other side of the house are definitely best in class in the market. We're doing some unique things. So, you know, I would say you can also go to our website and just sign up for free and try it out. Right? Yeah. We don't have a heavy approach. We're pretty open. We're pretty confident in the product. So we also want you to be able to kind of kick the tires and get your hands ready.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are you guys in any of the marketplaces like AWS or Azure?
We are. Yeah. So actually we're in the big three. So we're in the AWS marketplace, Azure, as well as GCP. And, you know, I think to be honest, we don't do a ton of transactions through those platforms. I would love to say that we're, you know, some giant company that, you know, a ton of people are just flooding in every single day, but you know, we like to work with our customers as well. Yeah. I think, you know, for observability, even though it does boil down to metrics, events, logs, and traces, it does get an order of magnitude more complex when you start to optimize those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. At what are you in the COSOL program for any of those clouds?
So, you know, I have some meetings tonight to get further entrenched in some of those programs. I think, you know, obviously Amazon, Microsoft, and Google have been super gracious and are very supportive.
Yeah.
But I think we could be doing more.
Yeah. No, that's always like the thing that you kind of, you know, we work a lot with our portfolio companies, and I scaled hundreds and hundreds of companies, and in the two biggest marketplaces, not GCP, but a lot of my former colleagues now work over there at GCP running the same program, the same playbook. But yeah, I think the general advice is to most startups out there, get to co-sell as fast as you can, get transactable as fast as you can. And then basically, then you could start doing account mapping with the account execs at the big clouds and be like, hey, we're really trying to sell into blah, 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 you know, Fortune 500 company.
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
And it retires their quota, you create a private offer, and, you know, and that happens somewhere around the Series A or B kind of timeframe, typically. Where are you guys, by the way?
So we're now Series B. So nice. We've raised just about $82 million so far. So yeah, we have quite a bit of funding and a lot of resources, and you know, we got a great
team. So you're kind of right there at that juncture now. So we could talk about podcasts, but we have partners, resources that can help with that, and you know, so if you're interested, we'll figure it out.
Perfect.
What's your vision for, you know, Edge Delta over the next 5 or 10 years?
You know, 5 or 10 years is a long horizon. So I like the way that you asked that question, because, you know, at the end of the day, we talk about this a lot internally. And, you know, if you went 5 or 10 years before you get to a technology where you truly can just take all your data and collect it and start looking at it, and 5 or 10 years in the future is a future where that is completely unfeasible. You know, some of our large customers do petabytes and petabytes of data that they create every day.
Wow.
And so when you're starting to get to the petabyte scale, you have to start realizing that not every single thing needs to be stored forever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, looking at the future and looking
at the end
of
the universe,
right?
The cold,
right. I mean, like,
dark,
in the future, if you were both financially and technically limited from being able to store any more than 1% of your data, what does that look like? Like, what is 1% of your logs?
What do most companies
like?
Do when they have that kind of scale? Do they just start trimming it with a time scale? Do they start compressing it? Like, what is the solve for that?
Yeah. So, you know, going to, I really admire Warren Rogel, who's, you know, CTO over at Amazon.
Yeah.
And he had this great talk at reInvent last year, at the end of last year. And he kind of talked about this concept of like two different houses. And the two different houses, one was using 50% more energy when it comes to their heating bills cost. I think this was like, I don't know, maybe the 1900s or something, early 1900s. Yeah. Or something. Yeah. I don't know the time frame, but they were perplexed and they were baffled at like, how could one house that looked very similar, had the same windows, had the same insulation, be using more energy? And it turned out that the house that was using more energy had the meter in the basement, and the house that was using less energy had the meter right inside the front door.
Oh, I love
where
that.
Where when the owner of the house
I'm
came in, they
this.
Can see how much they were using. So I think the first thing that we need to do is for organizations to implement pipelines, and obviously that is one of our core products, to just be able to understand what are all my data sets coming in, how much is coming in every single minute, how much is it creating.
Crap, I'm storing a petabyte a day. What is going on here? Do I need to do that? Like, where's
exactly.
the value? Yeah.
Exactly. At the end
having
of the day,
having that meter
right?
in front of you. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Like, you need observability because you need it for solving business problems, right? You need an ROI. If you're going to spend $1 million a year on observability or you know, $10 million a year on observability, it better be solving a $10 million problem, right?
Mm.
And so I think the understanding and the awareness of the data sets is step one. Then from there, of course, you can be very thoughtful about what do you want to sample? What do you want to filter out? What do you want to pre-process? What do you want to pre-aggregate? There's a lot of tool sets, and I think that you know, that rabbit hole goes pretty deep. So I think ultimately, you can get very advanced with this, but step one is definitely to put kind of a you know, data pipeline, observability pipeline in place for you to first even just be able to get control and awareness of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So back to that 5, 10 year question, what does that look like for you guys?
Yeah. So I think, you know, for us, it's really around focusing on our differentiation and on the areas where we're best in class. So, you know, that is pipelines, that is the ingest layer, that is, you know, helping organizations be able to see and understand and route and control their data wherever they want it to go. And then it's also on the automated insights front, right? So obviously ChatGPT, which you mentioned, is kind of a big step up.
And what is ChatGPT, you know, then, again? I'm just joking.
Yeah, right. You know, then 4 gets released, and I think everyone's waiting for 5 to get released. So, you know, I think it's...
Are you guys implementing large language models in any of your workflows?
We are actually. And so some of the unique things that our product does, we have had external validation in the form of customers and people that do analysis in the market, saying that we are best in class there. That's surprising to us because I feel like we're just getting started, but it is always good to get that validation.
Yeah, it seems to me that, I mean, like a big part of the Melt framework is basically looking at what's happening and making a decision on it, right? And it seems to me that large language models, and I use it in a lot of my venture capital workflows, you know, you can kind of prompt it in the right way to, and you're probably even below that, you're probably going down into the fine tuning of some of the models, which we can talk about. But it seems to me you could have it read the logs in such a way that it kind of gives the automated insights in a way that was probably hard-coded in the past in a very deterministic coding kind of way. Now you can have large language models being like looking at stuff and kind of reasoning out the ambiguities. And
yeah,
maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
I think the most interesting area in this space is the fact that, let's take ChatGPT for example, right? They had to be very careful about how they roll out access to APIs. It's less of a problem when you have humans with our inefficient fingers typing on keyboards, putting in prompts. And then when you have actual, you know, software that's prompting and asking
100 tokens a second through the keyboard.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, how many words per minute can you type? Right? Yeah. So, you know, I think then instead, when you actually have these systems that are asking ChatGPT for all the inference and all the feedback and all the answers, the rate at which you can do that, compounded with the rate at which data is being created today, presents a very interesting problem. So, you know, the idea that you have to pre-process and curate data sets very carefully to decide what you're putting into these LLM models, to me, is actually a much more interesting part of the space than, you know, the training aspect or the specific model that you're using. And so that's really where we focus, and that's where we are. You know, frankly, I would feel pretty confident saying that we are innovators and visionaries in that space of understanding how do you curate data sets in real time to be able to feed those into LLMs without just completely destroying your own margins.
Yeah, and where do you think this all goes? I've been kind of debating this or kind of turning this around in my head around the future of SaaS, right? And with large language models infiltrating all aspects of, you know, product development and coding and sales and marketing and the list goes on. Where do you think we end up like in 5 or 10 years with all these large language models? Do you feel like in the future there's like an agentic workflow for Edge Delta where it's like, it's just, there's like this analyst agent reading the logs and sort of just communicating with the head of DevOps or IT on what's going on. And it's just like, it's almost like a, like you're talking to, you know, like the movie Her, like somebody in your earphone, and you're like, oh yeah, that's going on. Okay. Yeah. We should check that out. Like, what does that even look like?
I think I'm pretty confident. Okay. I'm pretty confident. I don't know anything, first of all, but I'm pretty confident that, you know, it's going to take a while for us to get past the stage of AI recommending something. And as humans, we have the final say. I think no matter how strong AI and LLMs get in the next 5 years, I still think there's going to be resistance to us just saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to give you full access and privilege to turn off and on anything and do anything you want.
That's going to take a decade or two.
It's going to take a long time, right? And then even further than that, right? You know, we can all just sit on the couch and play video games all day. And, you know, AI just basically just does all the work for us and pays us a stipend.
Right where I'm sitting, I'm just sitting here playing video games every night.
Exactly. And then, you know, AI can just pay us a stipend based on all the work they're doing. You know, until we get to that, I am excited to see kind of how the problem evolves and how you say, okay, you know, first the problem was that we couldn't do analysis on it. Okay, great. Now LLMs can actually give us a pretty good first assessment of what a log message means.
Yeah.
Okay, now the problem is, how do you curate that data to actually put it into the LLM? And then once that's solved, you know, then you get to the next problem, the next problem. And I think that kind of progression
Like this cascading waterfall of agentic workflows that we still have to solve. And then, it's almost like this new platform shift came along that enabled all this new stuff in large language models, you know, and now we're kind of stringing that together and orchestrating it. And then after that, it'll probably be another orchestrator of orchestrators, right?
I mean, look, I think the acceleration is accelerating is the way that I like to think about it. I mean, it's like, you know, the speed at which we are innovating and we're having to innovate is only going to get faster and faster. You know, at some point, you know, people say, okay, well, you know, at some point it's just going to be AGI and it's the game over or the start of something.
I think it's like, it's kind of like a fractal, right? Where we're just going to have 1,000 flowers blooming, where we're creating more value than ever in the history of humanity, because we'll all be accelerated by these exponential AI technologies, right? Where I may never have to hire anybody for my venture firm. I may just have like AI agents doing my deal screening and doing the deal memos and doing the due diligence. And I just review it. I'm like, yeah, that looks good. That looks good. And then I just do my podcast, you know? Maybe that ends up being an AI avatar of myself, right? Based on past recordings.
And in that fractal analogy, does that mean that every new startup does an infinitesimally smaller portion of life?
Yeah, and I've been also thinking about that. Does the pie get sliced up or does it grow? I think it actually grows. And if you follow kind of long-term trends of our economy and technology, I think it's an exponential, right? I mean, if you look at like the history of humanity, it's just like all of a sudden it's like this. And so right. I think we're hitting this like singularity, not of just technology, the technological singularity, but also there's like an economic singularity where we're just creating so much freaking value that maybe our $3 trillion deficit won't matter in 10 years. Anyway, I could talk another hour about this stuff, but why don't we switch to a rapid fire to wrap up, because we're almost out of time. Sound good?
Sure.
What's one technology you cannot live without?
One technology I can't live without? I would have to say just the internet. I mean, I do sometimes have fantasies of like what would happen if the internet just went away and if I just didn't have, if I wasn't a cyborg anymore, if my phone was
good,
no
like
longer
vacation
in my
resort. I wonder if that exists, like where you just go, like it's a week.
I think it's a phenomenal idea.
And there's no Wi-Fi, there's no cell service, there's nothing. And like you just have to like live like it's 1995 all over again, or maybe 85.
And I saw on Reddit, I want to mention Reddit, of course, because of their, recent IPO. I hope they're going to do well. I'm a big fan of Reddit. And I saw on Reddit the other day, someone had posted, were the early 90s really like that? Like, could you just run around in the neighborhood and your parents never cared about where you were?
Just
and
knock on people's doors.
As long as you're home before it got really dark, everyone was fine with it. And it was definitely it. So I think your resort idea has some merit. I think that could be something that you and I invest in.
Internet free resort
that like basically makes you lock your phone up and doesn't let you do anything.
Yeah, you like turn in the phone. You let people know, hey, I'm at this hotel. You can call the front desk, like old school, and leave me a message. Yep. Otherwise, we're kind of like Wi-Fi free. That'd be interesting. What's a book that has significantly influenced your life?
Book that has significantly influenced my life. I would say more recently, I actually, as we all know, we had this, whatever you want to call it, the Great Recession, or this, macro level bursting a little bit with valuations. And one of the things I actually did was have a large part of the team reread, because a lot of us had read it already, The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Yes, so good.
By Horowitz. So, just such a good book. And I do kind of draw some of those examples from time to time. So I would say that's probably, if you're a founder and you haven't read that book, I would say definitely put it on your list.
Must read before you leave your cushy sumo logic job and start a company. I love that. What's one misconception about data observability you frequently encounter?
I think the concept that you need a single pane of glass and you need all of your data in that single pane of glass. The concept that, every single piece of data is equally valuable. That, unfortunately, is definitely not true, and it's going to be less true in the future. So, I would say that's probably the biggest misconception. And I think a lot of people that are early in their observability journey still have that mindset. And, it might be an okay mindset at, a gigabyte of data or less per day. But anytime you get to scale of terabytes or petabytes, that concept goes out the window pretty quickly.
If you could solve one global issue with technology, what would it be?
That's a tough one. I think with technology, global issue. If we could somehow, and this is a really tough one, but if we could somehow get rid of bias, you know, our own internal bias, and even the bias that kind of creeps into some of the systems that we have, I think we all want to have data-driven decisions. Being able to have technology that can actually grab data at such a rate that the sample size for all of your data sets are sufficiently large to be able to give you the ability to make data-driven decisions, that would be pretty remarkable.
That's very cool. I was thinking about like partisan politics, right? Can we redo our electoral college political system in such a way that really represents the people, right?
I mean, do you need technology for that? I don't know that that's a technological problem.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. And bias, right? Bias in media, like you said. I think that's really important. What's a hobby you've picked up recently?
Hobby I've picked up recently? You know, I think I'm pretty busy with a startup, but I don't know if you can call it a hobby, but being a dad. I have an 8-month-old daughter, and I have a 2-year and 8-month-old son.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, once you have kids, I think you realize sometimes how selfish you can be at times when, you know, work is very stressful
parental
and it's
guilt.
Very busy.
Yeah,
and
then,
you know,
exactly
you always
want
to spend more time with your kids.
Yep.
And so, you know, being a dad, I don't know if that counts as a hobby, but I think that that definitely has been probably the biggest change and transition in my life in the last few years.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really enjoyed the conversation. How can people get in touch if they want to find out about Edge Delta?
Yeah, feel free to message me on LinkedIn. That is probably the solution I use most. I write articles on there. I do posts. I'm not big on social media. So, you know, I got off of a lot of social media when I started
LinkedIn
Edge Delta.
Media.
And I never looked back. I mean, for any type of professional reasons,
yeah.
You know, you absolutely need it. But I think for personal reasons, although I do miss the idea that I can post something and my whole family can just, you know, see a picture or get an update from me, you know, I think that's beneficial. But I also think for your own mental health, more people should consider, like my dad says, going, he got out is what my dad says.
Yeah,
so.
I took all the social media apps off my home screen. And so I end up like checking them like once a week now. My wife will be like, hey, did you blah, 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 da, 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 to hear about that thing? And I'm like, no, I haven't been on Instagram for like 10 days. So let me go look and see what you're talking about.
Yeah. So reach out to me on LinkedIn, especially if you're going to talk to me about logs, metrics, traces, observability. That is what I love to talk about. So feel free to reach out. No matter who you are, I'm happy to chat.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.